Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Cole Hornaday.
Hey, Ben.
Chris Casso.
Hello.
And Nicole Lam.
Hi.
How is everybody this fine evening?
Loki.
All right, and let's just get on with tonight's show, shall we?
That's probably for the best.
We're doing good. I got an Optimus.
Do have an Optimus Prime, and I swear to God, I'm going to bring mine next time.
Now?
Swear to me. Yeah, I know.
Swear to me.
I was in the store.
Where are the other drugs? Why did you say that name?
I guess we're going to get going. I was in the store recently, and a customer was in here and mentioned that we should have a topic. Why does 90s X-Men suck? And I'm like, oh, okay, well, that sounds like a good topic. I didn't know 90s X-Men suck because I didn't read X-Men in the 90s.
It's an opinion because there were young people who were reading X-Men at that time, you know, 12, 13, 14, 15, who are considerably older now, and that was the period that they look upon fondly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really about the age group when you kind of discover something.
Yeah. Right.
For me, I agree with the customer. I think it was one of the most gluttonous areas.
I don't think he actually had that thought.
Hmm.
I think he heard us mention it during one of the stumble bounds.
Oh.
And because we talked about crappy events.
Okay.
And so he thought it would be great for us to talk about it.
Okay.
But I don't think he had a particular distaste for it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So my first question is, does it?
I will say yes for the most part, yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
I will say a vast majority of it does.
Yeah.
And I will say I don't care about the X-Men.
There you go.
Fair enough. So if we're talking about mid-90s, let's put it at 1993, because I think that's when the cartoon came out.
Yeah, the cartoon started in 91.
Yep, 91.
And that has a lot to do with how the X-Men were shaped in their publication life and the stories were told.
And breeding the nostalgia that would love that period, yeah. So that would be my period of X-Men because if it's 1991, I was 9 years old and I really did like the X-Men at that point because I was all in that train, you know, like, ooh, Gambit, ooh, Wolverine, he's a mean guy and da-da-da-da-da. So it's not until like years and years of, you know, jaded comic book retail that I can look back at them and be like, oh, so much franchise merchandising and just
so
nice.
I was in my 30s by that point and starting to hit and starting to get to the point where I've seen these stories repeated over and over and over again. But in the 80s, the X-Men started to exceed other Marvel comics, like they sold better than I think they sold better than Spider-Man, Fantastic Four especially, and it was the X-Men started splitting off into different comic books, the New Mutants, and they were more and more comic books. They started glutting their own market, as far as I can tell you.
X-Factor.
But along with the cartoon came Marvel bought a toy company and redubbed it Toy Biz in 1990, and they started grinding out in 1990. By 1998, they're grinding out like several dozen lines of X-Men toys, and they weren't even very well designed, but they were tied into with the cartoon, so kids were snapping them up like crazy, and they were everywhere. But there were three different scales. There were the 12-inch ones, there are the 6-inch ones, and then there were like the 4-inch ones.
So did I want that Apocalypse, and when I got him, his power was you can extend his legs.
Yeah, they
were, and they make him slightly taller.
Poorly designed. I think that is Toy Biz still the brand name they use for the Marvel Legends line? No,
it's Hasbro.
It's Hasbro now. Mm-hmm. Okay, but that kind of contributed to the glut that was happening because X-Men was everywhere. The cartoon ran had 76 episodes and then permutated into. There was the one with the teen X-Men
Evolution.
Yes, X-Men Evolution,
which I never saw all of, but was better.
Yeah.
was good.
But it had really had nothing to do with what had been established in the comics or the cartoons.
Yeah.
But after a point, and then we start seeing tons of crossovers. And I think, I want to say it was the X-Men books that started the crossover thing.
Ooh, that could be some research for an episode.
Yeah.
But they definitely were instrumental in glutting the crossovers and making them a staple for Marvel. So that's where I think a lot of our, like, the 90s suck really happens, because it burns us out. Because there's Executioner's Song, there's
Follow the Mutants,
Asgardian War thingy, which had lots of mutants in it too.
Extinction Agenda. Did you say that already?
I think I said Executioner Song.
There's too many X's.
They became so derivative of one another and one another.
The Phalanx Covenant.
Yeah, and they and when you have that many, and there were like six or seven, even dare I say eight books on X-Men books on the stand that they were crossing over.
So you would have Uncanny,
right.
Adjectiveless X-Men, X-Factor, X-Force, New Mutants. Cable would get a series, Gambit would get a series, Wolverine had a series. You have a lot of miniseries for Storm, Gambit, Rogue. Cyclops every once in a while, but then everybody remember they don't like Cyclops.
And
Colossus.
Then fell asleep.
Yeah. Nightcrawler.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's just so much
and
glut.
Also, and so when you have that many X books, you got to have at least a variety of supporting characters. And we started scraping the bottom of the barrel on supporting characters.
Maggot,
Marrow,
Kylan,
Skin. I am okay with Cypher. Cypher was the guy, his power was omnilingualism.
Yeah.
So he could speak all the computer languages, spoken languages. To me, that was a character who just was too smart for the series.
Right.
And you put that kind of weird character in the hands of somebody like Grant Morrison, and you're doing something, you can do some really cool, funky, potentially psychedelic things and be like, like a Legion kind of story. But
so do we blame the 90s for all of these weird, like silly mutants that popped up everywhere, like that have really bad mutant powers?
There were characters like Skin, who had, somebody who had stretchy skin.
He had excess skin.
Excess skin. So yeah, they weren't. Yeah.
Every one good one, you had at least five blech guys.
And I can't tell you if there were any characters that came out of that era that I actually liked.
Part of my problem with a lot of that era of character creation, too, there's an old test that I forget where I read it, but it was a conceptual test, and it was this idea of show somebody who doesn't know comics a poster of 500 characters and ask them, figure out who Spider-Man is. Got it.
Right.
Batman. Boom. Superman. Yeah, you can figure that one out. Gambit. Cable. You just start being like, what? These aren't like descriptive names. They're just edgy names, And it's just like, okay, more of this stuff.
So we also started seeing characters that were, we started seeing a lot of hot artist-driven titles. And as a result of that, a lot of these hot artists really, really kind of really celebrated hypermasculinity. And that meant Rob Liefeld styled, broad-shouldered, tiny head, little feet, but,
gritted
bristling
teeth.
Bristling with weapons.
Yes.
What all the hardware and the armor had to do with being a superhero was always lost on me, but that sold books.
It's exhausting work. You have to keep your protein shake somewhere.
Why don't ladies have a million pouches? Like, all the girls had no viscera, no internal viscera.
No, they didn't.
Listen, the ladies had to be
stealthy.
Was
it in their boobs?
Yes. The less clothes, the more ninja you can be.
That's right.
So then they had, like, Cable just hold all their stuff because he had all the pouches.
Exactly. Oh, that
hey,
would
put
be...
put this in one of your 20 thigh pouches, would you?
That needs to be a thing.
Oh, my God, that would be good.
Where at some point, like, somebody's just like, I really got to sneak through this. Hey, come over here, Nathan.
Hey, could you just like have my apartment keys in your pouch, please? That'd be great.
He's just like, fine.
And so we're hitting a period of like of great prosperity, actually, for comics, because of the speculator boom. We've got all the variant covers. We've got the hard artists. But we're also getting tons of character overexposure. We got Wolverine is in every other Marvel title across the stand.
And this is where you see the birth or of the strengthening of the careers of Jim Lee. Mm-hmm. And guys like Wills Portacio, Mark Silvestri, and in the late 90s, you got other new talents popping up. So, I mean, yay, new talents.
The market boom, or the boom turned into a bust, and it was pretty bad.
Yep.
I mean, we were looking at you know, because people are sitting on 62 copies, variant cover copies of the new Jim Lee X-Men, that's bagged and with a little collectible card in it.
Yep.
And they're worthless, and they still are.
Some of those. Yeah. A lot of the 90s books
still
are.
See a lot at thrift stores that have never been opened, buddy.
Yeah, I know. But if you get the one that has the Deadpool card in it, that's worth $5 more.
Okay, well, you know, best of luck.
And it has been
there.
Almost like 30 years, right?
Yeah. So the trick is some of the market's changing simply because those were still on newsprint, and it's harder to get nicer copies on newsprint.
That's right.
Not necessarily for the content, but yeah. As far as Sucktitude, though.
One of my questions was, did comic book collectors and comic book readers see this decline of X-Men quality go down at the time? Or in retrospect, does it just seem obvious to us?
I saw it happening, but I kept reading them because there was this, for me personally, I don't know about you guys, but there was a certain aspect of just forward momentum. I would pick up 2 to 3 X-Men books a month, and it was comfortable. It was comforting.
Yeah.
I was in graduate school, and I love the X-Men, but I never really stopped. I could not tell you what happened in any of the stories.
It's a lot like, it's melodrama. It's a lot like watching Days of Our Lives and soap opera. Every day. And it's just like, Betsy and Scott going to have that affair? Mm-hmm. You know, and da-da-da-da-da-da. And then, who time traveled today and met their alternate future clone of themselves.
Which might be why it appealed to teens. Right. A lot of teens, right? Yes. Why it's nostalgia now.
But I think it lost the edge with LGBT Q teens, because it really X-Men in the 80s, that was a key audience back then.
I don't know. I feel you like think? There's a lot of 90s kids that still hold it, but maybe they started earlier.
So I can be wrong in the way I perceived it, but I always felt that the X-Men's social relevance morphed every decade, and from 60s through 80s, it was civil rights issues. Mm-hmm. Specifically, everybody could not help but say, oh, Magneto's Malcolm X and Professor X is Martin Luther King Jr. And once we hit early 2000s, it flipped to LGBT. Mm-hmm. And so I feel like with our customer base right now, that's a stronger relevance.
Okay, cool. Because I don't read X-Men anymore. And it was about the 2000s, I got so bored with the time travel, the splitting. And I still was feeling the oversaturation. And that's why I'm actually really curious about the Hickman stuff, because I tried to onboard again, like when...
the last revamp?
when Bendis brought the teens from the 60s forward, I was really curious about that for its mashup quality, and I did start reading those, and for about 10... 12 issues, I was thoroughly enjoying that because there was this weird nostalgia vibe. And then how are these young people from the 60s, and of course they lost touch with, you know, this kid's taken, ripped from a different culture practically into the present. But I'm really curious what Hickman's going to do, because I miss my X-Men. I have not been able to relate to them for a really, really long time. What was the book, Oh, Killstrike?
Yeah.
That sort of like did this wonderful, nostalgic, also satirical take on that 90s period of grim and gritty superheroes.
Yeah.
And that started to really, you know, the Cable stuff, the Deadpool stuff, that just really killed my enjoyment of all of it, because and Wolverine's bloodthirsty nature, it just got dreary and sad. Mm. I got bored with it.
My berserker rage. Yeah.
I'm assuming all this is just because Marvel got greedy.
Well, yeah.
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 That was because
they're
no
not,
other reason.
They're not in it to be artists.
They never not got greedy. They're still greedy.
Yeah. At first it was Marvel, now it's Disney. It's just who controls the greed?
Kind of got to remember, they're not there to make art. They're there to make money, and lots of it.
Mm. So what good came out of 90s X-Men? We heard that some of the talent that came on the books back in the day.
And there's been interesting stories. I mean, we're talking about years and years and dozens of titles.
Actually, we'll get to it when we do book report, because this X-Men Grand Design kind of hits that time period.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I am having a hard time. I mean, the nostalgia is good. Again, it's a perspective thing because there's a lot of people who don't share our feeling of the oversaturation.
Yeah.
And they look fondly back at that stuff. Yeah. And like Age of Apocalypse was a big story. And when I read it as a kid, I thought it was great. And I look back at it now and I kind of wince, but there's still ideas that are good-ish.
You're trying.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, there's some fascinating ideas there. And before they oversaturated time travel and alternate realities, a lot of our tropes come from X-Men, mm-hmm. you know? So there's ideas there that are worth noting.
I mean, say what you will about the Heroes TV series and the fact why that it, you know, the first season I thought was so astounding and then it crashed and burned so badly. A lot of people blame that on the writer's strike. Me, I think, okay, but also someone at NBC or CBS said to, who is it, Jeff Loeb? Or
Loeb?
Was he?
Jeff Loeb was.
He was the showrunner?
I feel like it.
Yeah. That
sounds about right.
Yeah, and I think someone said to him, do it like the X-Men. Yeah. And the first thing that they did was have Hero, the character who was the time traveler, and then it just started turned into, you know, this potpourri of, mm-hmm. of time travel silliness and tropes, and it was giving you a headache to try to keep track of it. And that's what was happening in all the X-books, too. It's like, this doesn't necessarily inspire better storytelling.
Well, they've influenced so many other creators, Ed Piskor for one.
Yeah.
And also, like, even the Umbrella Academy, when you watch the season on Netflix, it's very much the Dark Phoenix saga. Yeah. At least to me it is.
And to me that's why it works.
Yeah, you know, so there's definitely, it influenced other creators to do more and better fiction. So mm-hmm. there's a good there.
Cool. Yeah, yeah. Totally. You know.
And my last question on this topic is, can you think of any other properties or titles that had a period of suckness like the 90s X-Men?
All the 90s.
Yeah.
Everything in the 90s?
Well, there was a period of desperation in the 90s. It was the Heroes Reborn.
Well, before we even touch that, okay, there's the period. The reason Heroes Reborn had to happen was like, let's just focus on Captain America. There's that whole period where he became a werewolf.
Yep.
And then there's that period
That's a good period.
Yeah. Well, then like soon after that or before that was when he started getting the soldier serum was poisoning him and he became like emaciated and they gave him like super armor and like
Mecha America.
Everybody had mecha armor for a while there. Batman had his super armor. Mm-hmm. Superman kind of had kind of a weird period with his long hair. Yeah. And like everybody just got extra armor
and hair.
Yeah. And yeah,
subtle, so that subtle what's the party in the back thing?
Mullets.
Yeah. Like mullet. Yeah, it was like late 80s, early 90s, where everyone was doing that more like biz cash mullet.
Yep, yeah. Yep. So, I mean, like everybody, it's kind of like when everybody has that bad period in college or high school where you're doing trends. Like
it's
comics has
a period
those.
Of experimentation.
Yes. Yes. There you go.
All righty. So, yeah. Any final words on 90s X-Men?
There's gold nuggets.
Yeah.
Here well, and
I mean,
there.
And the introduction, just some nuggets. The introduction of Nathan Summers is actually kind of interesting. You get Mr. Sinister, who's actually kind of an interesting bad guy, yeah. And Apocalypse shows up.
Weird thing, super quick. So the cartoon did Apocalypse, and he appeared before in the comics in X-Factor, and he is very boring in the comics. Mm-hmm. And the cartoon just gave him a really cool voice actor, and he had some great lines. And I think everybody loves Apocalypse, but when you read the entire history of Apocalypse comics, he virtually does nothing.
Hmm.
There's not one single good, oh yeah, that good Apocalypse story. There's a couple that are supposed to be the big ones, but like he doesn't do much and he sucks in them. So like there's just this weird like thing about this one villain who should be better and is cool, isn't.
He's also an awful lot like Mr. Sinister because they're both like, you know, they're both puppeteers. They manipulate people's genes and stuff and they've been hiding in the shadows and pulling the
He made Mr. Sinister, yeah. So that's a thing, right?
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So he's accurate in the X-Men movie universe then. In that he's crap.
Oh, yeah. Right.
Yeah. Cool. Are you going to review an X-Men book for Book Report?
Yeah, I am.
All right. Let's go ahead and do that.
Oh, okay. Well, I've reviewed Ed Piscator's X-Men Grand Design books in the past, and actually I thought, well, I'll just talk about the latest one because we'll be talking about 90s X-Men. And actually, this one, Grand Design, I'm sorry. So if, in case you're not familiar with the Grand Design books, this is what John Hickman calls stories about stories. And it's really just sort of a primer on the history of the X-Men done with Piscator's really unique...
Piscor.
Piscor.
Piscator. Piscor. Ed. It's Ed's unique illustration that's kind of like Fantagraphics kind of undergrounding, but one of the, but they try to inject the publication with some nostalgia, like they printed on this off brown tone paper stock.
But there are still bright white parts.
That's right.
Which is weird.
Yeah. But it's almost like your little history book for the X-Men, because it's annotated and it's footnoted. So this one covers the period from like the mid to late 80s up to... the mid-80s to, let's say, up to the 90s. So it's, yeah, I think the last reference is to 1989 and then 91. But I think it's relevant to what we're talking about because it sets a lot of the tone for a lot of the stories that become more the way that the multiple X-Men comic books hinge around in the future. This is where we meet Madeline Pryor. And Madeline was when Jean Grey, the Phoenix, sacrificed herself on the blue area of the moon. Scott Summers, Cyclops, goes into a deep, deep depression, quits the X-Men for the umpteenth time, and goes to travel the world. And what's the first thing that happens? He signs on to work on a boat that's piloted by a woman who looks exactly like Jean. And it's so odd and it's so strange and he can't figure it out. Well, come to find out, Mr. Sinister has had his hands, you know, he's been playing with the gene pool a bit, and eventually Scott impregnates Madeline, and that baby is... baby is Nathan Summers, and Nathan Summers eventually becomes Cable. And I think what happens is they wind up taking the baby to the future, and then
Gene
Hawes...
To save him from the virus.
Yeah, it's because he has a techno-virus.
Yeah.
And they take him to the future.
And he's raised by a couple called Slim and Red, who are actually the souls of Cyclops and Phoenix, teleported to the future, so he was basically raised by Gene, who's not his mother, but is his mother.
And you don't like this title, is what you're telling me, Nicole.
I hate the X-Men, like, more at the end of this podcast than I did when we started.
However, the Adventures of Phoenix and Cyclops, the original 2-4-part series, were one of Gene Haw's early gigs, and they were extraordinarily beautiful and unique and unlike anything else on the stand at the time.
I do like those. Side note, Piscator sounds like a 90s X-Men villain, because they had a lot of villains called Fitzroy and Fabian and Piscator.
Yes, yes. Piscor.
Piscor.
Yeah.
All right.
This one covers stuff like, you know, you meet Madeline Pryor and the Morlocks, who are actually, if you've been watching the Gifted TV series on Fox, are the more unsightly mutants who live underneath the city in the sewers or in a secret subterranean place.
You got your sexy mutants and you got your fugly mutants.
Yep, and then actually, and this is the time when Sabretooth gets incorporated into as a big bad and as a nemesis of Wolverine, when actually he was introduced as a bad guy in Iron Fist back in the 70s. Mm-hmm. But this is really when he gets centered as a superstar, supervillain, and becomes like the arch nemesis. And is he actually the brother of Wolverine?
No.
I've never understood that.
No.
But they kind of like play with that kinship that he has with Wolverine and Sabretooth have. So
I'm furry and got claws. You're furry and got
that's
claws.
That's right. Yeah.
We're brothers.
We both have
berserker rage.
Did we just become best friends?
Berserker rage.
So, and then, and this is the era when Storm has her mohawk, and So I thoroughly enjoy reading these. It's kind of a refresher. It's like, oh, I remember that story. But I got to tell you, as we talked about earlier, this is a period of X-Men where I was really starting to lose interest. And there are turns in the story.
It's so messy.
Like,
man.
Where they, you know, meet this goddess, Roma, who is a big character in the Excalibur series, because time and space and timey-wimey stuff in Excalibur.
The Siege Perilous.
The Siege Perilous, ugh. Where they walk through and try to go to a better life, and then all get bounced back. And then there's like the, and then Madeline becomes the Goblin Queen and summons all these demons, and it gets really, really loopy and ungrounded. And so, yeah, Ed is hitting that period of X-Men where I started to lose interest, yet I was still reading it. And I think I read a lot of these X-Men comics from this period in a comatose state. But what he's done is still remarkable, and I do enjoy these. And if you want to catch up and you want to learn about what all the hoopla with the X-Men was about, these are a lot of fun. But also the, just his ability to capture that nostalgic quality in these is worth it. But, you know, I don't know if that's going to mean anything to anybody who hasn't read these books prior.
It's still informative.
Yeah.
And it should be noted that they are doing, like, the loose floppies as the series comes out, but then they are doing these nice oversized treasury editions for the full collection.
Treasures.
So it's kind of obnoxious on a bookshelf, but I think it's worth it because his art style and all of his writing is all blown up, and you can really appreciate what he's done in those collections.
Yeah.
So that's a good way to collect it as well.
Cool. Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you, Cole.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Casso, what do you got for us?
I've been reading nothing but DC events.
Yeah, yes. Apparently.
Specials. So Superman Leviathan Rising. Leviathan Rising is going to be an event, Bendis's first event at DC. And so they're starting it with a $10 prestige format book that's supposed to kind of just introduce you to what all the hoopla is about. It's written by Brian Michael Bendis, Greg Rucka, Matt Fraction, Mark Andreyko, and it has like a bunch of people attached to it. So basically, it's I guess Bendis, I stopped reading his stuff a while ago. He's introducing that there's kind of like a secret empire in Metropolis, and there's actually a really interesting character who's she's kind of like the evil Amanda Waller.
Which How can is, that be?
Yeah. Well, she's basically like a secret person who's in charge of everything in Metropolis, but it's because no one knows who she is. I'm like, okay, I kind of like that. And Leviathan shows up and starts talking to her because he wants her advice on how to deal with stuff and how maybe he can take care of fixing the world in an evil way or something like that. And so they decide, like, maybe I gotta kidnap Clark Kent. And Superman, like, overhears this, and he's like, oh, I'm going to let them do it so I can figure out, I could get a story out of it. But then they actually, like, effectively do it and mess up Clark Kent and Superman. So there's an interesting story there. It connects to Talia al Ghul, so that does mean it connects to the Grant Morrison Leviathan stuff. But this is where it gets interesting. So the parts that are not written by Bendis start happening, and Greg Rucka is going to be doing Lois Lane, and it's a whole focus on Lois Lane, and I really like the tone of that. And then you get the Matt Fraction section, which is Jimmy Olsen. And this is where the magic happens, because Jimmy Olsen wakes up in Gorilla City from a book tour. And he wakes up apparently married to a interdimensional jewel thief. And all his clothes are missing. And there's a cat in the bathroom who's destroyed his clothes. And that cat is the evil Red Lantern Dexstar, who just vomits blood everywhere all the time. And there's like this protracted like 2 pages of this cat just vomiting blood. And it's so great. And Jimmy Olsen's just like, okay, I gotta take this in stride. And like he decides he's gonna go on the adventure to help save Superman. And he's like running out of a hotel full of gorillas with a cat and covered in blood. And that is the tone for the whole new Jimmy Olsen series. Nice. And I am down with it. Then there's a Supergirl story that I couldn't care less about. And then it gets back to the Bendis section. And the Bendis stuff is okay. It's just he does that thing where everybody talks like Bendis. So this whole new villain called Leviathan is supposed to be the big kind of threat, and he looks kind of cool, but he just talks like a guy, like a real mutz, I don't know. And he just he tries to Yiddish. And like there's this like whole sequence where he's like talking to Talia al Ghul, and he seems threatening, and then he's just like, oh wow, you okay, fine, sure, blah, and like a billion word balloons happen, and it's like, this is your villain, and he just sounds like a guy.
Yeah.
And that's Bendis's thing. Yeah. And I get that, but you can't do that all the time.
Yeah.
So there's interesting elements here, but mostly it's all Jimmy Olsen. And I recommend this book, even though it's $10, fully for cat vomiting blood for 5 panels. And then the rest is fine, too. So,
yeah. All right. Superman, Leviathan Rising. Thank you, Chris. Yes. And finally, Nicole, what do you want to tell us about?
I think it's like Bendis really likes periods, so he tries to find ways to put periods, you know? So everything is a sentence. Like, yeah. Oh, my God. Becky. Yeah.
Look at anywhere.
Yep. Look at these comics.
Look at her book.
Look at my book. Oh, wait. That's Miss Marvel. I'm not going to talk about Miss Marvel right now. I'll talk about it later. Some other time. But for now, we're going to talk about... Oh, hi, there's a mic. For now, we're going to talk about Brendan Graham and James Stokoe. And they came out with some art books. They used to be roommates with Corey Lewis, and their styles are kind of similar, and they're great. These are oversized, lovely editions. It's good to note that Brendan Graham's Royal Boiler is a soft cover oversized at $24.99, and Grunt is a hardcover oversized at $40. I feel that it depends on where you will find your value. The books are both set up. Oh, God, this is not working, guys. Heavy. You know, I'm just awkward right now. The books are set up very similar, where there is like previously unpublished stuff. There is a lot of cover work that both of the artists have done. Brendan has done a lot of stuff for different Image comics, and James has done a lot of stuff for like Marvel. A lot of his weird Marvel variants are in here, which are really fun. Both of these artists do a lot in detail, so they love putting little things in the background and making, you know, inanimate objects or little aliens or something, and everyone has a personality and everyone has some sort of character and something that they bring to the table. So I love both of these artists for that reason. The cool thing about Grunt is that there are unpublished works from James Stokoe with, like, Orc Stain. That's something that's kind of been abandoned, it seems like, for now. Mm-hmm. And so you get some stories, like you get stories of like where orcs come from, which is grotesque, obscene, and really delightful. And you know, you just get a lot of like really cool black and white art. You get some of his stuff from Dark Horse when he did Aliens. His color stuff, he's got a really interesting color palette, and his detail work is just like it's like almost unprecedented. I don't know. It's just really, really cool. It takes a lot to do that sort of stuff. So I think that they're both worth it for the price. I'm thoroughly enjoying this, and I'm also finding it very informative too. Like in Brandon's one, there's stuff in here about his new comic that he's been working on. And I didn't even know he was working on something. So it was really cool to be like, oh, cool. What is his next project? I'm really excited about that. And then like, you know, bits and pieces of stuff from his history, you know, different comics that he was like, I'm never republishing that because it's terrible. But here's some covers of it so you can learn a little bit about it. So these books are super great if you like the artists, if you want to know more, if you just want to appreciate their artwork. If there's like, you know, variant covers you never got your hands on because you don't want to play the variant game, but you like the art. I just think there's so many multiple reasons to get these books. They're so much fun to just like pick a page and pour over them. And just thoroughly like dissect that stuff, and it definitely wets my whistle for their stuff. That's all that came to me right now.
That's legit.
Because they don't publish a ton of stuff, and there seems to be a bit of a desert between their work, which is fine. You know, they're still working on things. They're still doing whatever they're doing. But it definitely fills that void for me for now. So I highly recommend Royal Boiler and Grunt by both of these amazing artists. Really cool indie stuff. Not both. One is published by Image, the Royal Boiler. One is published by Dark Horse, Grunt. The cool thing about Dark Horse is they do great hardcovers, which is probably why this is a hardcover, because they love them and I love them.
Mm-hmm.
So art books.
Cool. All right.
Excellent.
Great. Thank you, Nicole. Well, that is Book Report, and that is our show. Coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound podcast is brought to you by the Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, as well as Comic Extension here at 309 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsengine.com. Subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts or however you get your content at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And now, friends, get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. This week, the questions are coming to us from me.
What?
All right, we just spent some time talking about how the X-Men sucked in the 90s. Let's turn that around. Here are five questions about things that peaked in the 90s. Number one, popularized by bands such as Nirvana, Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, and Alice in Chains, this style of music is most closely associated with Seattle, flannel, and apathetic Gen Xers.
Grunge.
Though I still faithfully listen to this music, I have stopped wearing my flannel shirts tied around my waist.
Oh.
I totally did that. Number two, also called milk caps. The game pieces for this game were about the size of a poker chip and had a fun image printed on one of the sides, making them incredibly collectible.
Pogs.
Pogs is correct. I will admit this game missed my radar, and I first heard about it during an episode of The Simpsons when Milhouse effusively states that Alpha's back in Pog form. Number three, also known as the Millennium Bug, this problem with the way computers were programmed to store dates led to a decades-long worldwide panic about the apocalyptic scenarios in the event of all computers malfunctioning simultaneously.
Y2K?
Y2K is correct. In fact, John Hamry, U.S. Deputy Secretary of Defense, stated that this is, quote, the electronic equivalent of El Nino, and there will be nasty surprises around the globe.
Nasty.
P.S. to that, nothing really happened. Number four, this service was one of the early pioneers of the internet in the mid-1990s and the most recognized brand on the web in the United States. And chances are, you probably still have some of their CDs in your house giving you 1,000 free hours.
AOL.
AOL is correct. And finally, during the last half of the 90s, these little stuffed animals emerged as major collectibles and at the height making up 10% of eBay's sales.
Beanie Baby.
And one of the saddest pictures on the internet is of a divorcing couple dividing up their collection on the floor of the courtroom.
Oh,
that is so quiz sad. Time, and that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.
Thank you.